You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The concept of journalistic objectivity doesn't immediately come to mind when you're talking about the Chinese media, and journalism in the PRC is often dismissed as the mouthpiece of the communist regime. But globalization and the rise of social media have been loosening the government's grip in recent years. Fred Teng, CEO of News China, and Xiaojing Rong, a reporter for Tsingtao Daily, join us now to talk about some of those changes in Chinese journalism. Welcome to our show. Fred, isn't News China the English version of China Newsweek?
Yes.
That's a state-run news agency not connected to the American Newsweek.
It's a magazine called China News Weekly. Mm-hmm. It was established 15 years ago. It's a Chinese version. And in 2008, we launched an English edition in New York.
Is the content of the English and the Chinese versions identical, kind of like what... Or is it similar to Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic?
It's difficult. It's different because of two different languages, two cultures. Originally, we thought this would be 70% translated, but at the end, it cannot be done.
And how big is the readership of the English version?
Right now, worldwide, about 80,000.
I would assume mostly people involved with business?
Business, academia, think tanks, and some government decision makers, but as well as libraries and people who has an interest in China.
Xiaojing, Tsingtao Daily is a New York-based newspaper. Do you have any connections with journalism within China?
Our headquarters is actually in Hong Kong. Tsingtao New York is an edition of Tsingtao Daily, the general newspaper, and we cater to the Chinese community here. But I personally write for several Chinese media outlets based in China as a freelancer. So I have some experience of that.
Well, living in New York would affect your perspective of the Chinese media, wouldn't it?
Well, you mean my thoughts about...
Well, if you were writing for a... for example, if you were writing for the New York Times, mm-hmm. you would approach it quite differently, wouldn't you?
No, I think actually for my part, I don't feel there are much difference while I'm writing the stories for different news medias. Only like I'll put in mind that who are my audiences and what their culture is, so you know what kind of stories are news for them and what are not news. But in terms of journalistic methods, I don't think there are any differences.
Can you talk to your fellow journalists in China freely about the news they're banned from reporting?
I can talk to them, yes, but I don't think if I write anything about like political reform or anything like that, they'll publish that.
Fred, when she was asked about the limits of investigative journalism in China, Yuan Yingchan, dean and professor of Cheng Kong School of Journalism and Communication at Shantou University, said, "You can't talk about Tibet. There's no exposing the Politburo or their sons and daughters' business interests. No discussion of June 4th, 1989, the Tiananmen Square massacre. No Taiwan. No Xinjiang. Those are drop deads, and then you have room to navigate." So where's the navigating taking place?
Yes, I think that people have to understand China is a country in transition. It is only 63 years old. They have went through a number of catastrophe movements. One is the Cultural Revolution. The other is the June 4th of 1989. And those movements both have, you know, personal injuries, death, damage of properties, as well as paralyze the whole society. I think that one of the things the Chinese government is very wary of is instability. If there are any instability that create a kind of chaos again. But in terms of discussing it, criticizing government, it's going on in China all the time.
But sometimes you don't know what the rules are. Going all the way back to Mao, when he said, "Let a million flowers bloom." Was it a million flowers? And then
100 flowers,
whatever. And then people started speaking freely, and they found themselves in serious trouble. that can lead to an awful lot of fear, can't it?
Well, I think that's still the situation now. Like the policy is not very stable. Sometimes you can talk about this, but when there's some sensitive political occasion comes up, suddenly you can't talk about this topic anymore. But the thing is, the trend is toward more open and more freedom. We can feel this like 10, 20 years ago, you know, things like, you know, I wrote a piece for a Chinese language magazine based in Beijing about whether President Obama is a socialist. That's kind of when they asked me to write that story.
Because he's being accused of that by conservatives
exactly.
in this country.
Yes. And when they asked
Chinese
me to.
Chinese must be confused by that.
Right. And so I was surprised that I'm like, is this really a topic that you want to talk? Because when you write the story, you have to inevitably mention the situation in China. And they said, well, I think that's fine. The editor told me that's fine. As long as you don't directly criticize, you know, the sensitive things in China. But you can say it in an insinuant way, which I did. And that seems fine.
Because so, part of the confusion is China a socialist country, even though it calls itself a communist country?
That's true. Too.
A friend wrote me last week from Beijing, and he noted that talk about time travel is banned. Have you, either of you heard about that? And why would that be a taboo subject?
I don't know. But sometimes there's obscure things that government also doesn't want people to, you know, it's not just about that, but about, you know, people make overtly claim of things that's not realistic. Then they just thought that they don't want the citizens go wild over something.
A Romanian reporter, a writer, told me that during the Ceausescu years, at a certain point, the government announced that there'd be no more censorship. And everybody thought that was great until they started writing whatever they wanted to write. And then they realized it was a lot safer during the years when the rules were very explicit and they knew just what they could write about and what they couldn't write about.
Well, but I think also, you know, if you're talking about this, what China is today is very different than China is 60 years ago. If you compare year to year, month to month, there might not be too much difference. But if you look back every decade, you look back 10 years ago and then 10 years ago. Because when in the Cultural Revolution, Dan Rather said, it was very hard to cover China. In fact, even most of the reporters are in Hong Kong. Right now, a lot of the major U.S. media, they're all in China right now. They're writing story. I just met with a New York Times reporter. He was in Shanghai for 7 years. He said none of his article was ever not published.
He didn't have to clear it with the censors when he sent it out of the country.
No.
But he might not have been able to publish it in China.
But he's a New York Times reporter.
Yeah. Right.
Well, back to your previous question, I think it's kind of for the reporters in China, journalists in China, they probably enjoy a situation where the government won't put specific taboos to you so that you have this space that you can play with. I think journalist is a game like that. You know, like you can test the water, you know, just see what you can say now, what you cannot say. But eventually you find the space you're having is bigger and bigger. So that's kind of enjoying, I guess.
My guests are Chaoqing Rong and Fred Teng. We're talking about journalism in China. Hasn't Global Times, which is China's leading newspaper, published many articles about Tibet, despite the fact that Tibet is one of the taboo subjects?
Well, that's why, you know, when you say about these topics are taboo, I don't think so. I do think there are a lot of discussions about that. There are different websites about this, but I think that the positions are very different. What they report in the China media, what they write about, is coming from their perspective.
Or from the government's perspective.
Well, I think if you go to the people of China, if you ask them about Tibet or about Xinjiang or about Taiwan, I think you'll see 99% of the Chinese people in mainland China think Taiwan is an integral part of China and inseparable, and they do not want to see its independence. And the same with Tibet and so forth.
But isn't that simply because that's what the government has told them they should think? I mean, well, isn't that doesn't necessarily come from independent thinking, does it?
The silver lining in this, I would say, for Global Times, the English version at least, they want to send out a voice of China, that's for sure. But they realized, I mean, by talking they, I mean probably the Chinese government realized that if you want the whole world to listen to you, you have to play in the same rule of the world. So that probably the Tibetan taboo is not really effective with Global Times is because of its English language. It wants the English-speaking people to listen to it. So it has to build up some credibility.
Well, Global Times has also published articles about Bo Xilai, the former head of Chongqing, one of the four direct-controlled municipalities in China. Is it okay for journalists to expose certain kinds of government corruption? Because the reports were limited to his alleged corruption, but there was no mention of the power struggle that Western reporters reported in the party that was also part of.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the part when you talk about the Western media is talk about power struggle and scandal. From just personally, I look at that perspective is that if Bo Xilai have committed certain crimes, then he should be judged by the law. But I do not think there is any crisis in China in terms of, or any scandal in that way, is that if you have somebody violate the law, corruptions and so forth, then they will have to be dealt with.
But he also, according to at least the New York Times, mm-hmm. Represented a kind of a neo-Maoist approach. At least that's the way he was presenting himself, no matter how he really was conducting business. And that went against the trend in the party.
But he's been doing that for a long time. If that was something so offensive to them, they would have been do it a long time ago. If you think the whole point is that I think this whole situation happened because there is a alleged crime being committed and they do an investigation.
Well, I searched through the News China website, shows mm-hmm. little mention of the Bo Xilai affair. Was that based on a decision?
No, I mean, we actually reported it in the June issue. Mm-hmm. The case is this, is that we always report what is happening. We do not speculate in terms of what happens. We talk about a lot of the issues about China, about the society. We examine the one-child policy. We talk about domestic violence. We did talk about when Bo Xilai was attacking some of the corruption in Chongqing, we did the whole multiple articles on that just to examine what he does, who was accused of whatever the crime it is and so forth. But if the case has not been out yet, I mean, we do not want to be speculating like other media because we're trying to get people a better understanding of China.
Should we see the case against Ai Weiwei, the artist, as an example of media censorship? Because it began when he began making art pieces concerning the so-called tofu construction of schools that were destroyed by the earthquake in Sichuan province and blaming local officials for not having the highest standards in that construction.
I think both Bo Xilai and Ai Weiwei cases are a very important factor in this is the social media, where both story was broken by the social media. It started as rumors, and then that was after several days, the national media, the traditional media, started to pick it up. So when you have the freedom is much more on the social media in China than the traditional media. But the thing is, when you have when you are enjoying much more freedom on the social media, you have this vacuum that the traditional media sometimes suck information from the social media, the internet. So when you are in this situation, I think it's really hard to control the traditional media as well.
And although Ai Weiwei has been forbidden from talking to the media, he still has a very active Twitter account.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
People are following him all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
My guests are Zhaoxing Rong of the Tsingtao Daily and Fred Deng, of the CEO of News China. We're talking about journalism in China, and we will take a little break and come back with more. We're back with Fred Teng, the CEO of News China, and Zhaqing Rong, a reporter for Singdao Daily, talking about journalism in China. And Fred, you mentioned that you had written about the one-child policy in News China. Today we are hearing the New York Times had a piece about how China is reconsidering that policy.
Yes. I mean, China started with that policy because of an overgrown population and not enough resources at that time. And I think right now there are a lot of different people. One is that the government cannot support, you know, from their perspective, more than one child per family in terms of providing the resources for them. But a lot of the people are very wealthy, well-to-do, so they can do that right now on their own.
But there's also the other issue where people, they're much more likely to want to have a son than a daughter, and we're going to see a situation very soon where there just aren't going to be enough women for men to marry in the future.
Well, the country is actually controlling this kind of problem by, like, if you're a pregnant woman in China, they won't tell you, the hospital won't tell you whether you're having a girl or a boy until you give birth to the baby.
But we are seeing an awful lot of adoptions of Chinese girls in America simply because the families are abandoning them.
That situation is no longer true, because I don't think that anyone can adopt the young people from China anymore, because China itself is so affluent that those parents, sometimes they want one more children, and they will be adopting. You know, when you talk about the Sichuan earthquake situation, there was 2,000 orphans. And when that let out, within a week, they thought that a lot of Americans will be adopting these child. Or they have oversubscribed by Chinese parents. They say, we want to adopt these children. So none of these children was ever adopted by a foreigner in that sense.
Is there a censorship or propaganda department that journalists have to go to?
You mean what kind of
China,
for what
yeah.
kind of stories?
What department is in charge of media censorship in China?
It's not very established. I would say, like, things you see here in the U.S., like the PR offices, are not quite established in China. It's not like every company would have a PR office, or every government agency would have one. But generally, the propaganda department controls everything, I guess.
The General Office of Broadcasting and Television, Guangdian Zhongzhe?
Well, that's only the television.
Yeah.
And there are different administration, like we have FEC, FCC, and things like that. I think mostly is really to obtaining the license for publication. In the United States, broadcast media is controlled, but print media is not. China is both, broadcast, print, and internet.
But I've heard that a document to ban stories and words is issued every day to the news agencies in the country. Who's doing that?
I don't know about that, but I can speak for my own magazine. For our magazine, we have a team of about 30 people working in China. Our editor-in-chief sits in New York. We do not have to go through any approval process. And so forth. But I think we also look at our own articles and looking at what are the most important news, and so our editor makes the decision.
But don't most journalists know just how far they can go anyway and engage in self-censorship? They do that all over the world, don't they?
Well, they do it in the U.S. as well.
Yes.
When the Wikipedia published all those information, I think the major news outlets here, they all talk to whoever in charge in the government to see whether the story could be run, whether it could impair the national security. I mean, that kind of censorship, we see it all over the world. But I think the interesting thing in China, being a journalist, is really you can try your best to test the water. And that's actually a very intelligent game. Like, if you remember when Liu Xiaobo got the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, he couldn't go to the award ceremony because he's in jail. A newspaper in Guangzhou put a picture in the front page with two empty chairs. So that's
And what happened? Nobody got in trouble?
Nobody got in trouble.
Because other times we've heard of people being sent to,
yeah, the newspaper,
to prison.
But then people ask them, but the editor said, hey, don't try to think about what we mean. We mean what you see. So, you know, you can't say that they're really trying to indicate this is a Liu Xiaobo situation. But, you know, people can think. So that's the interesting thing, interesting part of the game.
Well, then I gather that there are all sorts of ways to get around the rules. For example, I mean, not in the way that we saw in Egypt, but when the government deletes something, it calls it harmonizing, and people can't say that they've been harmonized, but they then use the phrase "river crab" as a way of talking about being censored, because Khershir, it sounds just like. The river crab sounds just like harmonizing. Harmonizing meaning everybody has to be in the same boat?
But I think the way people are talking about this kind of things is not a new phenomenon. This is actually started from the history of China. There's a way of writing called Chunqiu. The method of Chunqiu started by, actually invented by Confucius. When he wrote the book, which called Chunqiu, he can't really directly talk a lot of things. So he used a lot of insinuation to indicate this and that as what really happened.
Confucius at the time was writing dangerous things, considered dangerous?
Yeah, there are a lot of political reasons or even politeness reasons. He won't really directly name a person and saying this is a bad person. But he wrote it in a way that on the surface, probably everything's fine. But if you're a smart reader, you can tell
For example,
what he really means.
One of the ways people avoid government filters is they write about the 35th of May instead of June 4th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So that's,
but everybody could figure that out.
That's really push your. That's really push your intelligence to an extent that's that's maximum your smartness, I guess.
People have to understand that they can read between the lines, or subtlety. They become more subtle because you can't just say things blatantly.
Well, I think also what you talk about, there are a group of people who's very interested in discussing that discussion. But I think the vast majority of the Chinese people in China, that's not what they're interested in. They're interested really into about their daily life, about improving of what's in terms of the education. They're curious about what's going on and so forth. And in terms of that discussion, I think it can go on, and there will be always to be a debate. I do think the situation it's improving, but it's not really the only issue about China.
My guests are Fred Deng, who is the CEO of News China, and Zha Ching Rong, a reporter for Tsingtao Daily. We're talking about journalism in China. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You said the people in China, you know, maybe this was a long time ago, so it might not apply anymore, but some years back, the head of the Xi'an film studios came here to present a film he had done. I think it was called The Old Well, which revealed some problems in China. This is during the kind of opening. And people in the audience, he was there, and people in the audience got up and they said, why do you want to air dirty laundry in the West? Why do you want to show people this sort of thing about China? And these were people who were living in America, who didn't really have to think of in that way. So perhaps there's also this other sense that we want to protect our image in the world.
I don't think it's just the protecting of the image. I think that there's just China certainly have a lot of great things to talk about. If we want to isolate it, talk about those cases, yes, we can talk about that. But what percentage of them really occupy the real space? And are they occupying 90% of it, or are they occupying by 5% of it? I think that there's a lot of great things that's going on in China in the last 30, 40 years. I think that in terms of the vast improvement, people's livelihood. I mean, you've been to China. I mean, you should go there, and not just once, but you should go at least three times, because the first time you're just establishing a baseline. You might see cranes building. You might see whatever. But when you go back another 3 months later or a year later, you see how much the people's lives have changed. And that's what the China story really is about. It's not perfect. It's got a lot of problems. And all the problems you talk about, it exists. But how the country is doing, they already lifted 300 million people out of poverty in the last 30 years. And they're going to do that in another 5 to 10 years, another 300 million people out of poverty. And that's a really, really major accomplishment.
Fishing villages wind up becoming cities with many millions of people.
Cities are important because urbanization. I go to China, I see a lot of the villages. I saw one village, you actually have to go in by a zip line. While the Western world having a zip line as for fun, they actually is that only path because it's a deep valley in between. They cannot bring in large items like rice, education, I mean, all of these different things. So China is urbanizing people. That's the only way that they can provide those services. While in the Western world, say, oh, you're forcing people. But they're really helping the people by delivering these services, and that's the only practical way to do so.
Besides China News Weekly, many other Chinese news agencies have opened offices in the U.S., such as Xinhua, yeah, which has a huge billboard in Times Square, CCTV America. Why is the Chinese media doing this?
Okay, the first, sorry.
No, go
okay.
ahead.
I think, you know, that has been a question that's been asked to me many times. And my answer to them is that, first, the reason that so many Chinese media are coming is that they want to report about the United States back to China. Just like Xiaoqing is writing even article, not only so they send their own reporter. Many of them have one or two reporters, and they will be running around trying to collect stories so that they can write back for their media. Some others, in terms of the English media, is that they just lack of an in-depth reporting about China. And we thought that's a need. I mean, for me, I'm very glad to work with this magazine because I'm using English as a common denominator to tell to people about what's happening in the society of China.
What's the great firewall of China that people often talk about?
Oh, that's the thing, that it's a software that probably would block some information, some websites that you can't view in China. But there are another a counter software that you can install that you can still, like, so they call jump over the wall to see all the
people use proxies to get past it.
Yeah.
Facebook and Twitter are banned in China, but China has its own versions of them, Renren and Weibo. How similar are they to Facebook and Twitter?
Well, I think it's pretty much the same. I mean, the Weibo started to require people to register with real name a couple of months ago. But if you look at Facebook here, Facebook originally, Facebook has this famous policy of real name registration. So there aren't many differences.
At a talk at Columbia University, you said that Weibo, the Chinese Twitter, played a critical role in the high-speed train crash last summer. Can you explain that?
That was actually, I think, some audience raised this question, and they participated in the Weibo interest, and they put a lot of information on that. I think after the train crash last year, there was some control. At first, it was fine, and then 1 or 2 days later, I guess, I couldn't remember it clearly, but there was some control of the traditional media. And then people put a lot of interest on Weibo and a lot of pictures so that the news are sent out.
So has the government now increased its monitoring of Weibo?
I don't think the real name registration actually had any effect so far. Some dissidents are shut up, but they were shut up before, too. So it's...
Well, Fred, we've seen the power of social media in the Arab Spring. It's often associated with the democratization of media everywhere. Does the Chinese government have reason to fear that a revolution can gain momentum through social media?
I think that I always tell people that Chinese people will not need a Twitter or a Facebook to help them to start a revolution. if they want to start a revolution, Chinese people would know how to do it themselves.
Well, they've tried in the past.
Well, back in the Yuan Dynasty, the mooncake was the one way for them to. So Chinese people are very creative. They don't need the Western tools to help them if they want a revolution. But I think there is the difference between a revolution and a chaotic event. And I think that, you know, while some still think about Egypt, we can have different opinion and we can do another show just talking about the Egypt, whether that was a revolution or not. I think also we're going back to what Xiaoqing was talking about. There was another situation. There was a lady who worked for a nightclub and someone was trying to take advantage of her and she stabbed the person to death. And so she was prosecuted. But because of the netizens, their opinions on the internet, she was released afterwards. And that shows the power of the people. I mean, if the government want to use strong arms, why do they ignore it? They're not ignoring it. They're actually listening to, and every government agency have their Weibo so that they can communicate with people, including the, you know,
That's true. There's a trend that government agencies are picking up this new method of propaganda, if you will, to put out their message. And they try to adopt a style like of talking that netizens are using on the internet, use the word like honey or dear, you know, like that kind of things to make you feel they're close to you.
Well, in the 20 years ago, people were writing things on the democracy wall. That was the equivalent of what we're seeing now with the internet. But you're suggesting, Fred, that Tahrir Square and Tiananmen Square are very different things?
Definitely.
In the end, weren't they all about people saying we have to have change in our government? We have to democratize?
Well, I think that, again, with Egypt, I think it's politically motivated. I think you have to look at who is behind it. I think you have to look at when Egypt, in terms of its political reform and its economic reform, will come back after what's going on. I have written an article about comparing China and Egypt in terms of the differences. Egypt's, all the leaders were all militaries. China does not have military leaders. They are civilian leaders.
But the military plays a major role. The military is force in China.
It is an important force in it, but they are not allowed to be involved in the politics. And that's always of course, you have to be enforcing that because military, as all military in the world, they would like to play a more important role, including our military, in the politics and in the policies. But I think that it is for the government to making sure that they stay in place to protect the sovereignty and so forth, or as crisis when there's going for rescues and so forth. But then they should not be really playing a role in that.
And so. I think Chinese people may be scared. A lot of them are scared by the result of the Arab Spring because, you know, Chinese people are really like a results-oriented group. They see that the revolution didn't really bring what they want. So.
Well, it was predicted years ago that globalization would bring a lessening of censorship. Do you think that we're going to see that in the near future?
I think it's already happening. You know, globalization, like when my concept is people in China, in a small village, can click your mouse and see all the information around the world. Now it's not all the information, but probably 90% of the information. And when people have this venue to get their information, the traditional media, the censorship on the traditional media would definitely be loosened because there's no other way. Otherwise, you have the freedom on the social media and on the other hand, you control the traditional media. And then so the traditional media have to pick up information from the internet. And these information, mind you, are not really done by trained journalists or they're not balanced and checked. So you end up with a lot of rumors in the traditional media. And they could say, it's not, we didn't initiate this. We got it from the internet. So That's a chaos in my mind.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. I've been speaking with Xiaoqing Rong, who's a reporter for Tsingtao Daily here in New York, and with Fred Deng, CEO of News China, which is the English version of China News Weekly. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.